Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs with 30 minutes packed with the latest South African and global news. We are live right now and then you can catch us as a podcast later. Stay tuned for interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts delivering all the essential updates that you need fast and focused. It's Wednesday, the 2nd of October, and on our program today, will operational issues at the Port Elizabeth Harbour put a dampener on the good news about the petrol price drop? Phase 2 of the government business partnership is announced. With a national Kasatu strike looming, how should employers be preparing, and what does Gen Z's measure of success actually look like? Effective today, consumers will feel some relief with fuel prices being cut by as much as 1 rand 14 cents a litre. Well, that's good news. However, it may be diluted some as fuel imports at the Port Elizabeth Harbour have been halted due to a shipping accident that occurred in June this year. What does it mean? Well, fuel has now got to be brought in from other areas, which obviously adds to distribution costs. I'd like to explore this in a little more detail now with Peter Morgan, Director of the Liquid Fuel Wholesalers Association of South Africa. Peter, a very warm welcome to you. So what then is the broad impact here and who specifically is feeling it?
Okay, the broad impact is that currently, if you look at the way our pricing systems work, the MDZ system defines Port Elizabeth as a supply point, which means that petrol and diesel is shipped into the vessels into the port. So when that accident that you were talking about that happened early in June, we then, as an industry, approached the department and said, you know, because it's no longer a supply point, we need an interim and alternate solution to supply fuel to the affected magisterial districts. And it is affected magisterial districts. This is the Port Elizabeth Harbour supply areas. So it is the Eastern Cape, but it also goes into the bottom of the Northern Cape and into the bottom of the Free State.
What sort of solution, Peter, were you looking for?
What we really asked the department for was is if you think about the Eastern Cape, if you think about the coast, there's 5 supply points down the coast. Port Elizabeth is one of them. If Port Elizabeth is no longer operating, then the way our pricing structure works, it says you have to find the cheapest possible alternative to getting product to Port Elizabeth. And if you look at it, how it's panned out, that actually is by road from East London. So what it really means is that you look at all those supply points that were from PE, and then you calculate them as if they were coming from East London by road, and then you find where they slot because of the kilometer distances into the current price model, and that gives you the new zone differential. Remembering, of course, that PE is zone 1 now, so it actually means that Port Elizabeth itself goes to zone 8 and not zone 1. And that's why there's a number of 25 different areas that the price changes differently for each area depending on the distance it was from Port Elizabeth versus the distance it is from now East London.
And East London is 650 kilometres away from Port Elizabeth, so one can imagine how this is adding to increased cost. So Peter, how then is your association working with stakeholders to try and ensure minimal disruption in the fuel supply chain?
You know, it's a very serious question because we say that this is actually not a pricing issue. It's a security of supply issue. Price, of course, is a big part of it, and that's where everybody focuses because that's where you feel the pain. But firstly, I think it's important that people understand that we've been carrying these additional costs since the middle of June. It's now 2nd of October before the change. So there's a lot of pressure on those who have been operating in these areas. But for us, you know, it's first of all, how quickly can we get this changed? Because the agreement with government is the moment that depot is opened, the following day, there's no reason we can't go back to the current numbers that we have in our pricing model now. But for me, you know, I think I'm trying to think about this now in long term. And I remember going through my memory that Port Elizabeth Harbour, they've been talking about a new supply point at Kucha for a long, long time. And then a couple of years ago, it all went dead because there was just too much red tape. I did see a note the other day, a press article the other day from Transnet that said there is a private investor that's approached them that says we're ready to do this. So for me, I'm now thinking it's time to look at this, you know, put pressure on all the systems that allow this private investor to come in and build a new depot where we need it in Port Elizabeth and take P into the new world. You know, South Africa's changed drastically over the last number of years. Refineries closing down, traders coming in. So, PE has been left behind a bit. We need to get it up front and somewhere attractive so people start using it as a reason rather than as a last resort.
Peter Morgan, what are your colleagues on the retail side of the fence telling you?
You see, that's one of the points, of course, is that retail is a regulated industry. So as a wholesaler, if you're delivering to a retailer and the price changes like it does, we can't pass it on. But of course, it's the retail price that changes. And I think there seems to be an understanding in the discussions I've had so far that says this is not, you know, the best possible scenario any could anybody have hoped for. But the worst possible scenario is a situation where, again, we're going back to security of supply, where people can't get product to where it's needed. And that's far worse than a price reduction this month.
Just finally, what sort of timeline are you being given in terms of repair in Port Elizabeth itself?
The last we heard from Transnet Ports was that they'd done the surveys and they were hoping it would be early in the new year.
Peter Morgan, thank you very much indeed, Director of the Liquid Fuels Wholesalers Association. I do appreciate your time today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, you will be well aware that phase two of the government business partnership, it's a transformative initiative aimed at accelerating South Africa's path towards a sustainable economic growth dynamic, job creation and infrastructure development, has now been announced overnight. Well, what does it mean? It builds on the momentum of phase one, I'm told, which it says made significant strides in areas like energy, transport and crime reduction. So where to from here? Joining us now, Martin Kingston from Business for South Africa. And Martin, firstly then, how will phase two of this specifically benefit the country? And I guess in terms of growth and job creation?
Well, phase two of the partnership is going to build on the successes and the progress that we made during phase one, covering the three areas that you're familiar with of energy, transport and logistics, and crime and corruption. And we saw real progress during the first phase, the elimination of load shedding. We hope it'll be permanently the implementation of many structural reforms, both in energy as well as in transport and logistics, enabling the private sector to play a much more significant role, and putting in place the apparatus, the structure for dealing with crime and corruption, particularly capacitating the NPA. Phase two is about leveraging that capacity, putting in place additional resources, both for business as well as for government, with the explicit intention of addressing some of the very fundamental challenges that we still have in energy. We've got to construct 1,000 kilometers of new transmission lines over the next year. We need to accelerate private sector investment in generation capacity. We need to fast-track procurement through bid window 7. We need to strengthen the regulator, strengthen NERSA. In the case of transport and logistics, I think we're all very well aware of the fact that Transnet is struggling, despite the fact that significant changes have taken place, both at the level of the executive management and with the oversight of the board chaired by Andy Lesanglu. But rail capacity needs to be significantly increased. At the moment, the mining industry is hemorrhaging as a consequence, and not just the mining industry, of the constraints both on the rail and port. Expediting the network statement, and again, as I said, ensuring the participation of the private sector. And then finally, in the case of crime and corruption, you know, what we're clear about is we need to remove South Africa from the FATF grey list. That will result in an improvement in our credit rating, a reduction in our cost of borrowing, an acceleration of investment in the country, and of course, an increase in confidence levels. And all of that feeds through, and I'm sure you'll come to this, to the ability to create sustainable jobs. That's the biggest single challenge that we have as a country, with a particular focus, and we raised this yesterday at the launch of phase two on our youth, where we're aiming to create an additional 400,000 employment opportunities for youth by the end of 2025.
Has the dynamic changed in any way between the principal parties, given that we now have a coalition or a government of national unity?
Yeah, I think it actually has. It's improved. Not that we didn't make good progress during the sixth administration. It was the sixth administration that commenced the work of Operation Vulindlela that we're leveraging here. It was the sixth administration where we assembled the structures that we're talking about, and we enjoyed very significant support. But there's a new energy, Jeremy, I have to say, a new positivity, and everybody is fully committed to the structural reform that is necessary, to the role and participation of the private sector, to harnessing all resources wherever they are and subject matter experts to ensure that we can drive this change as quickly as possible. I think there's an awareness not only of the challenges that we face, but of the opportunity that we can seize if we actually, as a country, collaborate effectively and get our acts together. And that was detectable not only yesterday at the launch of phase two, where the president and many of his ministers were present, but at the first formal engagement we had about 6 weeks ago between government and indeed the private sector, where there was very significant representation from the GNU. And as I said, that sort of energy was palpable.
How do you make sure from both sides that one side isn't co-opted and the other side isn't capitulating?
Yeah, that's exactly correct. I mean, we do need to make sure that we stay within our lane as the private sector. That's particularly the case with respect to crime and corruption. We need to respect the independence of the criminal justice cluster, but we need to be able to cooperate with them and make available skills and capabilities. So transparency, I think the first point is the first key to that, holding ourselves collectively as well as individually to account. The second is that we're not saying that we shouldn't criticize one another constructively behind closed doors and even in the public domain. But really what we need to do is promote the potential of the country and indeed the collaborative aspect of the partnership. And I think that that's the way in which we do hold one another to account, by virtue of the fact that we're now creating very clear, definable deliverables in the context of critical paths for each of those three areas. We're looking at the possibility of adding additional areas, Jeremy, but we won't do so to the detriment of the three focus areas currently. And if we fail to meet the targets, then we need to be able to explain clearly and honestly why that's the case and what we're going to do to remediate the situation. So I do think that there is an acknowledgement that we need to respect one another's role in both society and in the country, but that in the context of economic growth, we can only do so by harnessing our respective skills and capabilities. In government's case, the implementation of structural reform. In the case of the private sector, obviously investment is the biggest single determinant of that, based upon the appropriate environment being in place.
And in that respect, Martin, how do you then deal with conflict to make sure that both sides get a strong and robust solution and that whatever you come up with is not simply a watered-down compromise?
Yeah, it's a very, very good question, of course, because the risk that we run when you have many people in the room is that you do sort of default to the lowest common denominator. We can't do that. We absolutely know what is required in terms of the architecture to underpin the type of investment environment that will spur the growth that is required. And therefore, I think that the private sector, although it is mindful of the constraints on government, is going to be very single-minded about creating the right environment, not just, by the way, so that they can secure appropriate returns for their shareholders, but so that they can actually secure returns for their stakeholders, which is the country at large. So in that regard, I think that we have aligned objectives with the government, but we need to be able to honestly speak to one another to ensure that we don't dilute, as you said, those overall objectives and standards that are required.
Is there concern within this grouping about forces gathering on the left who would be vehemently opposed to what you're doing?
Well, we've seen that already. We saw that for the first year. We celebrated the first year about 2 months ago, Jeremy. There will always be detractors, and we need to take them in our stride. The approach of, sort of, if you like, a sort of populist mentality, which seeks to undermine the progress that we're making, will always be present. But I have to say, it doesn't interfere at all with our commitment as business, nor, I believe, in the context of the resolve of government, certainly the GNU, to the partnership.
Do you believe that you have full buy-in from all business in South Africa, or are you still having to win over naysayers and detractors?
It's actually very interesting, because I think that we have, for the most part, absolute unconditional support from business, large and small, across all sectors, formal and informal. They recognize that if we don't address the sort of challenges that we've identified, the three areas that we're focusing on at the moment, but there are others, such as, for example, the water crisis that is emerging, such as the role of municipalities, which is primarily a political issue, that we're not going to be able to achieve, you know, the potential for the private sector. So, no, I've found very few naysayers within business. More importantly, we've seen that the CEOs, we've had over 140 that have now signed the pledge, and I think that we'll see more in the coming days and weeks, are getting personally involved. They're not just committing their companies, their sector, and the private sector, but they're rolling up their sleeves. We've got CEO sponsors for each of the work streams. As you know, we've just brought on another three, Simon Baloyi from Sasol, Mary Vilakazi from First Round, and Fani Titi from Investec, who are prepared to supplement and complement the work that's already been done by the CEOs who've been leading that work for the past 12 months. I think that there is a great deal of goodwill that we're able to harness, and as I said, very little by way of detractors within the private sector.
Martin Kingston, thank you very much indeed. Everyone has something to say when it comes to South Africa's energy challenges, but few know the facts, the context and the realities at the coalface. Tune in to The Current, the definitive podcast on South Africa's energy transition. From coal to clean and ICE to EVs, get the facts from the experts. To listen, follow Investec Focus Radio SA wherever you get your podcasts. Investec Bank Limited is a licensed FSP. T's and C's apply.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
As the nationwide COSATU socio-economic protest approaches next week, what impact, people are asking, is there going to be on business, and what's the position regarding employer preparedness? John Buerta is with me now, Joint Chief Executive of Global Business Solutions. He's been applying his mind to it. And John, welcome. What then will be the immediate impact, in your opinion, of this protest on businesses across different sectors?
Thank you, Jeremy, to you and the listeners. So the impact in my mind is just another disruptor to business on top of everything else that's taking place, just listening to the previous discussion on a number of the challenges. But being a Monday, Jeremy, and also talking about retrenchments that are rising, sluggish economic growth, as well, of course, as the escalating cost of living, we do anticipate this may be better supported than similar stayaways in the past.
So in that respect then, John, is there anything that employers should be doing to prepare for potential disruption?
They should be. I mean, the obvious thing would be to start proactively engaging with employees and the trade unions to try and gauge what sort of levels of participation there may be, what the appetite is in this regard. And then also, you know, for organizations to develop contingency plans and to look at what alternatives they can put in place, you know, should there be a significant support of the stay away. I think one of the challenges really, as I said, is it is a Monday. So the prospects of an extended weekend do apply, even though no work, no pay applies. And, you know, I just think that there's economic fatigue. People are hard-pressed from all sides. And, you know, we see retrenchments escalating, more than 1,000 businesses closing their doors. And the trade unions have been pushing hard, Jeremy, at Nedlac, et cetera, to have retrenchment law redefined to say that organizations shouldn't be allowed to retrench just to improve their profitability. You know, they should only retrench if they're facing business rescue or liquidation. So it is a hot topic. Obviously, NUMSA is an independent union that isn't part of the COSATU stable. So it's unlikely that unions and organizations with unions from NUMSA will experience disruption. But as for the COSATU unions, yes, there will be.
What type of contingency plans are you referring to?
Well, I think the contingency plans would focus predominantly on, you know, just preparing supplies and stock, potentially looking at temporary employment services or fixed-term contractors or casuals to bring in on those particular days. And then in areas where there may have been historical sort of criminal activity, looting, unrest, damage to property, vehicles, or blockages of entrances, I think organizations that may anticipate that level of response should prepare from a security point of view.
You've got to be careful, though, in terms of security. You talk about contract labor, for instance. Often that can exacerbate what could be an already tense situation.
You're absolutely correct, and that's another area that the trade unions have been pushing against, is the right of employers to secure what they unfortunately refer to as scab labor, Jeremy, as you know. So, you know, the level and the nature and extent of the contingency will depend largely on, you know, whether or not the workforce is unionized. But you are correct, employers need to be very cognizant of the fact that that is a very it's a very controversial topic in the mind of trade unions.
John, should employers be worried about this?
Look, I think employers are equally aware of and alive to these particular challenges. You know, I don't think there are many stakeholders in the South African economy, government, business, or labor, or the community for that matter, Jeremy, who cannot help but empathize with the plight of rising living costs, the plight of unemployment, those unemployed, and difficulties faced by business. You know, as I said, the latest stats, and you've probably been speaking about it in the other programs, but I mean, you know, over 1,000 companies liquidated. So I think it's something that everyone has a sense of unity around. The difficulty is in the way in which you express that. So yeah, it's a difficult one, and I think leadership and empathy is key.
What specific rights do workers have on Monday?
Yeah, so that's a very, very important question. So the first thing is, you do not need to be a member of a trade union, a member of COSATU, or any other trade union member to participate. So every employee, irrespective of their affiliation, has the right to participate. The second issue is, because NEDLAC have heard the matter and they were not able to resolve it with the Trade Union Federation, COSATU, it is what we call protected stay-away action. So that really means that employees cannot be dismissed for being absent on Monday. However, no work, no pay does apply, because if it didn't apply and people were paid, of course, we'd never be at work, Jeremy. So those are the two primary legal implications.
All right, I'm going to leave it there. John Boerter, thank you very much indeed for all of that clarification. Joint Chief Executive Officer of Global Business Solutions.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, let's stay in the workplace, but a slightly different tilt. The idea of success has changed significantly over the past few decades. For many Gen Xers and baby boomers, it might have looked like a stable office job with promotions and raises at key intervals, your own home, a happy marriage with children, and the means to live comfortably and without debt. But the so-called Gen Zs, that cohort born between 1997 and 2012, has a very different idea. More now from Nkosinathi Mahlangu, who is Youth Employment Portfolio Head at Momentum. And first of all, Nkosinathi, how does Gen Z's definition of success differ from previous generations?
Thank you so much, Jeremy, for this. Looking at the Gen Z's definition of success really has shown that they are very much a fast-paced generation, if I may put it like that. That also means they are very much tech-savvy and very entrepreneurial-minded as well. So they would definitely be different from the generations prior, in a sense that even their employment pathways tends to be slightly different from what we have been used to over the years.
And they're not necessarily just chasing money, are they? Work-life balance has become more important. Why do you think that is?
Work-life balance has become very significant, in especially when you look at what happened during the pandemic to around about 2019, 2020, whereby working remotely, had become something of a norm, if I may say so. And looking at where the Gen Zs are, they would definitely like a flexibility in terms of having that work-life balance, where mental wellness and wellness in general is also a big, priority in terms of how they navigate the world of work. And this also prompts potential employers to have a look in terms of how do we encourage the work environment to encourage work-life balance.
Employers, though, are not always rising to that challenge, and it often leads to frustration among this cohort.
It definitely does, and I think that's where the misalignment happens, where employers would like, specific deliverables and policies to be adhered to. However, looking in terms of the world of work now, where technology, AI also needs to be embraced, I think this also gives a perfect opportunity for the world of work to somewhat transform without neglecting what is priority, but creating that environment that is inclusive where Gen Zs could also drive as well.
That's interesting. How do you think you can create that inclusive environment?
It's a process, I must say, Jeremy. Looking at what even is happening in the Momentum Group Foundation projects that we are partnering with young people in, is where we find that balance where the young people would look for a purpose-driven organization to start with, to say, how is this organization connected, or aligned with the socioeconomic aspect of things within the community they're operating in? And that also builds corporate culture or the organizational culture where work-life balance, flexibility, embracing technology, and working smarter versus working hard. And that's where we need to strike a balance and getting, organizations or employers to transition into that without, deviating too much from their core.
The trouble for many employers, though, is an approach like that can be difficult. It can be unprofitable.
Most definitely, but also looking at where can it be applied and not pulling a blanket approach onto it. However, looking at various areas of business, especially where, new recruits or younger employees are coming on board, is to making sure that how do we make our environment, conducive for the talent that we're absorbing, and also making the organization much more attractive to young talent, which also could speak to potential clientele in future to say, how are we also attracting young clients to buy our products if we are a service-driven entity?
There's also competition among the different cohorts, and there are misconceptions, you'll tell me, about older generations and the way in which they feel about Gen Z's work ethic. What is that feeling that they have, and why do you think it might be unfair?
Well, there has been those misconceptions, especially when you look at where the world of work comes from. I mean, I remember the days where the FX machine was like the greatest, innovation. And looking at where we are now, technology-wise, and Gen Z is also, risk being labeled job hoppers, as they tend to, pounce to the next available opportunity. And I think it's merely based on what their values are in terms of, is this environment conducive? It doesn't speak to me and my values. Is there alignment? And then they would go and seek further opportunities. And they are much more looking for an environment that could also enable them to even do their side hustles because they are very much entrepreneurial driven. So they would like to have multiple streams of income while definitely making sure that they deliver where they are primarily employed.
And Kosanati, I understand all of that, but when the rubber hits the road here, Gen Zs might prioritize meaningful work. They might want to focus on the side hustle or the entrepreneurial venture. But at some point, a steady, meaningful salary does play an increasingly important role, the more responsibility you get as an adult.
Definitely true. And looking at how life happens in between, where you need to find something stable, something that you can, consistently build up from. And that solid foundation is required across all generations, actually, whereby a sustainable source of income is what would be priority, whereas other elements or other streams of income could be, you know, supplementary. But we need to have that focus, and Gen Zs are very much like that, because most of them, they would go the, you know, the route of acquiring some form of qualification so that they could you know, follow a career path that they feel best suited for. However, they would still try and look at where else can I make an income, because we have a very unstable economy and the cost of living is getting higher and higher. So they would definitely need to supplement whatever source of income they have primarily, and without definitely, you know, rocking the boat in terms of neglecting what is expected of them.
They have a different approach, a different philosophy. They have, as you've illustrated to me, have different demands. But come the end of the day, do you think they make good employees, and are they reasonably easy to manage?
Well, it also depends on them to say how do they, you know, meet the world of work halfway. They do make potentially good employees, and the case in point, based on the youth that we have even absorbed within our organization, to say where there is opportunities for young people where they could thrive, we definitely see them, you know, adding value, coming with innovative ideas in terms of how can we, you know, enhance some of the methodologies that we use within our environment. And looking at them as a value add, I would definitely say yes. And which is why, even though we have a very high youth unemployment rate in the country, I still believe there is room for Gen Zs in the workplace and in the world of business in general.
Nkosinathi Mahlangu, thank you very much indeed from Momentum. He heads the youth employment portfolio. Appreciate your time. Thank you. And on our last online poll, we spoke about the potential of the cruise ship economy. Is it huge, overrated, or is there a capacity issue as far as handling the volume? Half our respondents saying the entire concept of the cruise economy is overrated. And today we've just been speaking about Kasatu's strike, and my question to you, I'm worried, I'm planning, or it'll come to nothing. If you have a view on that, please participate in our daily poll, either on X or on LinkedIn. That is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.